Welcome to this, the first episode of the Rants Macabre podcast. I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
Every week we'll be covering all things horror.
Movies, TV, and the occasional book.
On this first episode, we'll discuss the prolific Stephen King.
His writing and his work translated to the big and small screens.
Enjoy.
We'll be focusing on the horror movie stuff and even, I guess, drama with horror, with notes of horror. Well, we can start off with The Stand. The Stand miniseries was made for, I believe it was ABC, but it was definitely network television. It was the first time that we saw like a full-scale sort of Lord of the Rings-esque, and that's even how he compared it. He said it was his Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
Randall Flagg, the Devil in Denim versus Mother Abigail and Lieutenant Dan. It doesn't hold up great.
False, number one. Because yes, it's very dated, but the story holds up always. I mean, it's like the Bible. It holds up. Good, evil.
It is. And I mean, it's not a coincidence. It's a biblical plague.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was, there's some amount of irony that it was made in 1994, but it actually feels pretty 80s with the like pop star musician.
Oh, yeah, I forget that he's like a Rick Astley kind of pop singer. Yeah, that's true.
How do the books age? I have to imagine they age better than...
Well, yeah, because you're not getting a visual image of the era. The book was done in the late 70s. Yeah, the book was done in 78. Okay. So, but you never describe the people's clothing. You never describe even politics of the time. So it's
no
ageless.
Point Randall Flagg is described as wearing a jean jacket and with buttons.
No, actually he is described. He is wearing a jean jacket in the book because he has a button with a smiley face on it.
Okay.
One of those have a nice day buttons, which is very 70s.
It sure is.
I think that
although
is the visual.
In the 90s,
and he wears jeans.
Getting as many buttons on a coat. That was common enough, but it was as if in the miniseries it wasn't good to leave good enough alone. They were just like, let's give him a couple more buttons. Some wardrobe designer,
he works at Applebee's or something.
Randall Flagg, you need more flair. How else can I say it? More buttons.
No, but in the book, actually, he is described. They specifically say he has a "Have a nice day" button.
In the book, is he a little more? Whenever he turns dark, I don't know if he takes on the devil face in the book, but is it more of a dramatic change when that happens because he comes off as a nice guy mostly?
No, I mean, I can't remember if he actually changes in the book because I haven't read it in maybe 2 years now. That's the best part of Randall Flagg is that he's a nice guy, but he's the devil. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's any person. Any person has that.
Okay.
That nice guy. And then just the next minute, he's throwing someone out the window.
Okay. They went pretty far with actually towards the end, he seems bipolar where he's like tearing rooms apart, throwing people off balconies. And then the turnaround, like, how's that drink? And he's like, you smashed it on the wall. Like, that's literally
yeah,
an
that's
exchange.
How he is. But that's okay. How Randall Flagg is. It's hard being the devil and like, you know, holding up all the bad people on the United States.
So my frustration with the anticlimactic element of, we'll get into the nuclear missile that Trash Man shows up with.
Sure.
But Gary Sinise is supposed to be your main character who essentially sits out the last act.
But that's a Stephen King tactic.
Is it?
You're always going to lose somebody you really want to be in the final.
In the book, does he finish the story?
Yeah, he goes back because he gets together with Fran.
Okay.
In the very end, he gets together with Fran. They have a kid.
Right.
That's Molly Ringwald. Yes.
Yeah.
But you're always going to lose somebody like, now I can't think of Rob Lowe's character. I always want to call him Ben Mears from Salem's Lot.
The mute.
Yeah, I can't think of his Nick. Nick, you lose him because you're like, oh, nice guy. I don't know. It's a Stephen King thing to sacrifice your people. Even though he doesn't die, it's just he doesn't get the payoff of being there in the end.
Hey, Trace, what did old lady Semple say when you torched her pension check?
Who's there?
People who play with fire.
Trash
with
Man,
the bed trash.
I really like his character. I thought he holds up pretty well, but the idea that he shows up with an ATV vehicle pulling a nuclear missile, and you don't even see how it sets off, really. Like, it's a very strange finale in the show. If I was watching it at the time, And I had invested all that time.
It's because of divine intervention. The hand of God. That's what sets it off.
That's right.
It's the hand of God.
Okay, that was another thing. The idea of the special effects in it.
Oh, well, come on, 94.
Sure. Okay, but this speaks to sort of the bigger themes of Stephen King stories translated with film or TV movies, as it would be. The moment they rely on special effects, they're going to lose a big chunk of whatever you're connecting to when reading a book.
Absolutely, because you can make it up yourself and make it look nice in your mind, but Hand of God translates poorly when you actually see it. Anything fantastical, I think, is impossible.
So I was thinking of that. The stories that rely on special effects, I think The Shining is kind of a strange standalone in that most of the Stanley Kubrick, and I think he sort of recognized that, like, even considering this is Stanley Kubrick who did 2001 A Space Odyssey, he's not shy about effects and practical effects and that kind of thing. But he probably looked at the book and he's like, I can't convincingly do a thatch maze that comes to life and have everybody look at it like, yeah, sure, that looks realistic.
Yeah, the shrubberies would be pretty, yeah, difficult.
So I think the stories that hold up the best in terms of the movie adaptations are the ones that don't use a lot. Like Misery is a bare bones story.
Yeah, there's nothing supernatural about that. There's just crazy people.
And Kathy Bates is so good in Misery that you really don't need any more. I rewatched it recently and I was so impressed that this is mostly a two-person story and it doesn't get boring.
Yeah.
If anything, the buildup of Kathy Bates' character as this nightmare of a swinging pendulum in terms of like that like Midwestern sweetness, and then it turns out she's a baby killing nurse with a terrible temper, and the townspeople kind of recognize that like she's a weirdo who flies off the cuff, but even when she does, she's, you know, everyone's a duty head, and
right.
But so the like I had a visceral reaction when she loses her shit. I don't know if it's in the very last moment. I think it is when she recognizes he's been deceiving her the whole time. This is more than just wandering around the house or anything minor. She chokes him and shouts and screams,
"I'm gonna kill you, you lying cocksucker!"
Those words out of her mouth, contrasted with everything that's ever come out of her mouth before, is an oh shit moment where like the hair on my arms just stood up.
Oh sure, I grew up, you know, with my grandma. I'm a Midwesterner, and I had a grandma who never cursed. You know, but she didn't. You know, she would say "oh dang" or even words like "dag nabbit." But you knew, like one time, this lady kind of told my mom how to parent, and my grandma stepped in and said, "Mind your fucking business, lady." And to me, it was just kind of like, oh, that's that Midwestern, there's a snap in it.
Right. You've read a large number of Stephen King books. The focus on the characters and character dynamics, it seems tough that like in a movie, they would think of that as like downtime. So they generally don't use a lot of that stuff, and I think they often lose what makes Stephen King great.
Well, I think, and that's the problem. I think that's why sometimes people can't get into Stephen King. It's a very slow burn because he wants you to care about the characters first and foremost. So you spend almost half of a book before action starts. It's like building up in between your characters, what's going on, and background stories of your characters before anything even really kind of happens. And I think it turns people off.
Are there any Stephen King books that go away from that start out quick?
Anything that he did two books with Peter Straub. He did Black House and Talisman, which Talisman is also related to Dark Tower.
It is. Okay, I think Talisman might have been made into a movie.
I think they're going to, yeah. And Black House is awesome because Black House is probably one of my favorite ones of his, but that starts off instantly. And then The Cell, if you've ever, that's a newer, later Stephen King book. It's called The Cell. It's based in Boston, and it's about a zombie signal over the cell phones. That's completely opposite of Stephen King. It starts with like,
do you think
immediately?
Do you think it's the outside influence that's like, let's hit the ground running?
Yes, because yeah. I could never even finish the book, and really? I've tried to read it like 5 times. I did finally finish it. I can't tell you even what happens because I don't remember it. And then I left the book in the hotel because I didn't want it on my shelf anymore.
What took you out of it that you didn't initially finish it?
It just wasn't Stephen King. I couldn't tell you what the characters looked like. I didn't know anything about the characters, really. It was completely opposite of Stephen King in that it was action-based and not character-based, and I just wasn't interested in that. But I think the best one he does, where it's actually a good book, is Black House and the characters, because you can see the characters. You know exactly what they look like. The main bad guy in that, you would love it. The main bad guy in that is based on Albert Fish. He's a little old man that's a child killer.
Is Albert Fish the guy
who
wrote the letters
of the parents? Yeah, yeah. Oh. It's an excellent book, but the main bad guy is this crippled, senile old man, and he has a twinner, which again is like in reference to Gunslinger series. I think Stephen King's, he does Supernatural excellent, but I think the best things that he does is take real people and have them just be awful, but they're just real people. Mm. Under the Dome is like that. Big Jim Rennie, there's nothing supernatural about him. He's just a bastard.
Right, right. You know? And I guess at a certain point, he's sort of protecting his son.
Right. And the son actually...
That's something you can relate to, the idea that like, where's the line? What would you do for family?
Right. And the son actually, he's a bad guy, but he's not even a bad guy. He has a brain tumor. That's why he acts like a monster. It's turned him into a monster.
Oh.
And then physically kind of turns him into a monster. That's what happens.
Did they cover that in the book, or they're just like, he's love obsessed?
In the book.
In the TV show.
No, because in the TV show, I think they were thinking long run, and you can't give someone a... inoperable brain tumor.
Yeah, although there's enough like magical nonsense where like you touch the orb and you're cured.
Yeah, he seemed to just be crazy in the show, the part that I watched, but I had to quit watching. Yeah. It was just terrible.
I mean, you watched enough to see him as like the love obsessed, you know, guy who's willing to kill, and then he's an honorary police officer, and then we forget about like the creepy kidnapping shit.
Because he had her in the basement.
And then he's just one of the Scooby gang. Then he's just along for the ride. The TV show. Okay, so that was something I was thinking about, that if you had never read one of the books and all you know of Stephen King is like, this guy's name gets used in a lot of different TV shows, and you know, mm-hmm. I would think there are a lot of hard misses. There's not good stuff that's been adapted. And I think a lot of that is because, God forbid, it gets turned into a TV miniseries where like it's got to be PG or PG-13, whereas like books don't have a rating. Like the moment you can read and you can buy a book, that's all it takes.
But getting away with Stephen King stuff on TV is
impossible. Yeah.
I think The Stand, though, is very close.
Really?
It's very close to the book. And I think... it is relatively close to the book.
Well, The Stand is also relatively... It's more like warring factions rather than... It's certainly not in the horror genre.
Right. No, it's like an epic fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it seems like more often than not, with the exception of like the more traditional narrative stories like the Shawshank Redemption, even the Green Mile's magical realism, but that's where I was going, that mm-hmm. he kind of plays with the... 95% reality, 5% somewhere else.
Right.
It's
like Dali. It's surrealism.
Yeah, but just like you have to kind of scratch the surface a lot of time to see it. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, follow a character a minute too long where they're up to something.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so the idea of the limitations of film, books are kind of still treated like the internet in the sense where there's no rating system.
No regulation.
It's a free-for-all. Yeah. Chuck Palahniuk talked about it in an interview where someone asked him about like writing for screen. He said, the moment you start writing for screen, you have limitations on what you can say, what you can show. A small percentage of the population read books. And they're adults, for the most part, who are going to be reading his material. So you can get away with anything. during a Q&A, Stephen King was talking about The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, the short story.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I think it's a novella, but it reads the closest he's ever done to, like, young adult fiction.
Uh-huh.
And because it's the teenage girl is the main character, there's not any profanity in the book. She utters,
I think she's even younger. She might be, like, 12 or something. She's a little girl.
Okay. She utters the word fuck once, one time. And he didn't even give it a second thought because he's not writing for a particular audience. His publisher gets in touch with them and says, if you take out the one fuck, we can put this book in school libraries. You can have all new readership of young kids, and they're thinking in terms of sales. And Stephen King considered it for a second. He's like, no.
Yeah, no.
He wouldn't take out one word that would probably equate to, like, a new generation of readers. And school library makes it a sort of standard in terms of availability. But no, he's writing the books. He's telling the stories he wants to tell. And I think especially now he's got fuck you money where...
I mean, it doesn't matter
to
him. You
can tell him what to write.
But at the same time, to even stay true to the characters. So she's a little girl and she's lost. And she wandered away from her mom and her brother who are arguing because there's a divorce going on in the family. And the little girl just wants to get away from it and escape. She wanders off the trail. I mean, it just gets worse and worse for the little girl. Like, she falls down a ravine, all terrible, terrible things. And so, you know how little kids, that's what you would say. There's no other word to say. Like, oh, well, fuck, you know, this is really bad.
Yeah. And for television and every other medium that uses his work, it's funny. Language is the first thing you'll sort of pick up on, that, like, this is all PG language or this is PG-13 language where, like, no one's speaking the way adults speak.
And if you're in a serious situation like that, you're not going to say, oh, darn it, you know, I just crap my pants. Darn, which happens to the little girl.
It's so conspicuous. Yeah, in a traumatizing moment, like, you're not... I mean, even if you're in front of kids, you're not thinking, like, oh, I better be concerned with my vocabulary.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's one of the luxuries that he sort of has, and you lose entirely the realism when it's translated to film.
Definitely. One thing, I think, I go back to Under the Dome because it's actually an excellent, excellent book, but it's very much, I would say, anti-religion. The religion is what gets these people in big trouble. I mean, they're selfish and they're self-centered, but there's a guise of doing it for religion. And so as soon as I saw that they were making it on TV, I said, oh, this could be really cool, right? And then I saw that it was on CBS and I said, oh, no, this is like, wasn't Matlock on CBS? They're never going to attack the church on CBS, you know?
Yeah.
It's just not the right crowd. And so I knew instantly, like, oh, they're going to fuck this up, you know?
I think the religious element, probably my favorite stories are like The Mist, where you have this outside horror of a threat, but it turns out it's your neighbor you have to worry about.
Right.
It's humanity you have to be cautious with. Mm-hmm. Everything else is predictable, but fucking people can be, you know, mysterious and liars, and, you know, who, like, devout people can be driven to some pretty strange ends.
Want another reason to get the hell out of here? I'll give you the best one. Her. Mrs. Carmody. She's our very own Jim Jones. I'd like to leave before people start drinking the Kool-Aid.
He's right. Like, your people get the better she's gonna look.
No, I don't buy that. It's obvious she's nuts. Look, a few people, maybe, but...
No, I count four. She's preaching to them right now. By noon, she'll have four more. By tomorrow night, when those things come back, she'll have a congregation, and then we can start worrying about who she's gonna sacrifice to make it all better. Hmm? You, Amanda, my little boy.
He's right.
You don't have much faith in humanity, do you?
None whatsoever.
I can't accept that. People are basically good, decent. My God, David, we're a civilized society.
Sure, as long as the machines are working and you can dial 911, but you take those things away, you throw people in the dark, you scare the shit out of them. No more rules. You'll see how primitive they get.
You scare people badly enough, you can get them to do anything. They'll turn to whoever promises a solution. Or whatever.
Ollie, please, back me up here.
I wish I could. As a species, we're fundamentally insane. Put more than two of us in a room, we pick sides and start dreaming up reasons to kill one another. Why do you think we invented politics and religion?
Oh, Jesus, that's just wrong.
I found it really surprising. It makes more sense now. But when he talks about his own writing, he never outlines. He is, in essence, going on this adventure with us and having, as he put it, having the story reveal itself to him. Now, you could see during a short story where you kind of find that the story wraps up quickly and you're like, oh, thanks.
That was nice, yeah.
But in the bigger stories, I would imagine something like The Stand or Under the Dome. Under the Dome specifically, you had issues with the ending.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was
because it's a massive book, and I have to imagine that whether it's your publisher or your own exhaustion, where you've written 1,000 pages and there's no end in sight, where you start having oh shit moments like, how does this wrap up? And then you start sort of trying to cut corners maybe and sort of rounding out a story that like, oh, maybe if I edit here and sort of change this character's behavior, we can wrap this up in a month.
Yeah. Under the Dome is one of those books that I would have rather just had it end. It'd just be like, this is a story in the couple of weeks in the life of these people. The end. They live in a dome. Who knows what happens? It's too bad.
Right.
But to put an ending on it like he did was so terrible. I don't want to give it away, so like I'm trying to avoid like that. It's just one of the worst endings you've ever read in your life. And this is the one who, at the end of Pet Sematary, which I don't mind telling the end of Pet Sematary because you should have watched it by now. It's your own fault. When his wife, Lewis Creed's wife puts her hand on his shoulder, that's an excellent ending. How does that same man write the ending to Under the Dome?
Well, it's a much shorter book.
He was like, this is great. The end.
Oh, I do what you say, Lord. Don't I always? But even your own son prayed that the cup be taken from his lips. And I'm praying the same thing. Probably get about the same answer, too.
Something that stuck out to me was the Mother Abigail character. That it's not the only time he's used the magical Negro archetype in The Green Mile, John Coffey.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, it's pretty uncomfortable.
Oh, I guess it's a stupid white person. I just say, oh, this is nice. She's a nice old lady. That's how I took it. I go, she's seen some things.
I can appreciate the contrast. And you know what? If it wasn't for John Coffey and the sort of going back to the well for the magical Negro archetype, I might have let it go because I like the idea of like, what's the opposite of blonde haired, blue eyed Jesus is a black, you know, kind of mammy type character. It's a little uncomfortable still when I'm saying it.
I think who knows what he was thinking. I think in some ways, but obviously whichever way I'm going to say it, it's going to be like as a white person, you know what I'm saying? But I think he was trying to find someone who, well, knowing in Maine, he probably did not know any black people. But I know people like that from my church that I grew up in. Like these women, 100-year-old women, and they've seen some shit. And I think it was kind of like the idea that she had really not had it easy. And so I think he chose not to have a white person just because I think he wanted someone who had like real trials and tribulations and still believed in God. And I think it had to be someone who had a really rough go of it that still believes in God. I think that's where he was coming from with that.
Yeah. And I think, I guess character wise, she's more of a conduit rather than the figure itself. He's never saying she's God, as you know, as opposed to Randall Flagg, which is a demon, the devil. It's unclear. But yeah, that she's more of like the, not even the vessel, but more of like the antenna, the word, the mouth.
Right. And I think, you know, she had lots of children, grandchildren, and seen things come and go. And I think that was kind of the idea, is that she had a really rough life that none of the other people could really understand. Mm. You know,
maybe even Stephen King himself.
Yeah. No, but to me, like, and especially when you see her in the film, there, that's like these women that used to go to my church when I growing up. So I just took it at face value and said, "That's nice." I didn't think anything social about it.
I don't remember when I had the thought. I think it was when I started digging, sort of comparing, like, he wrote this, he wrote that, he wrote that. And I started digging. Those are the only two times. Those are the only two times where he uses that kind of character, but they do stand out.
Well, Mike Hanlon in It is the only black character in It.
Okay.
It's probably, again, in it's Maine, to be serious. And he's the one who stays in Maine and he has to watch over it. And he's the one who calls everyone back as adults to come back to it because he's the only one who doesn't leave. So in that way, like, he's the rouser of the group. He gets everyone back together.
Okay. Speaking of the setting of Maine, what do you think of his use of, like, Castle Rock and, you know, the sort of New England small town setting? And then later we'll talk about the idea of his recurring use of a writer protagonist.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for the small town, because I grew up in a small town. I grew up in a town with maybe less than 1,000 people in it. So I kind of get that whole idea. The idea with him using Castle Rock, what I love, or just little parts of Maine, is that you see the people in other people's stories. So you'll see Mike in other stories, you know, and you see, and then even what he does is he takes Castle Rock, and Needful Things is supposed to be the last Castle Rock story. Cause you see some of the guys, Ace is in Needful Things, who is Kiefer Sutherland in The Body in, Stand By Me.
Right.
He's the helper in Needful Things. It's awesome. I love that shit because I'm a nerd and I like to feel included. Like, I know something other people don't.
Interestingly, it almost feels like community theater in terms of, definitely, like, recurring characters.
And you're like, there's Mike, faces, you know, or there's Pangborn again. And so that's kind of nice. But I think it also has to deal with him knowing that people sometimes are worse than monsters, just regular old people. And in small towns, you see it because people are allowed to be themselves multiplied by 100% of their personality. Yeah. I think they can get away with being a dick more.
And the familiarity with your neighbors is funny. Living in a city, there's a funny contrast to the idea of they're everyone shoulder to shoulder, but how many of your neighbors do you even know their names?
I only know the dogs' names of my neighbors. And I like it like that. But yeah, in a small town, everyone's in your business.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what's going on.
Rumor mill goes fast. I thought it also sort of serves as a contrast, the idea that in a small town, when something eerie happens, it stands out from the normality of your day-to-day. So in terms of telling a story, it is really as blank a canvas as you can start with. Whereas with the city, like, there's a million and one stories overlapping at any given time, and so much so that you don't even notice. So it's kind of, it's a jumble to begin with.
Right. And in a small town, also the game of telephone works especially quickly. And so the next thing you know, someone who got, like, hit by a car now suddenly got hit by a train, and they were set on fire, and then they were pushed by someone else. And so it becomes worse than it really is. And I think that's, in small town, I think that's what he preys on when he writes in a small town, is to make it exponentially scarier or worse than it is. I get
proportionally the scale is bigger when there's fewer people and something happens. It's just, yeah, that one person means a lot more. Whereas in the city, you get the sort of the watering down of, like, well, yeah, that happened to that person, but something almost identical happened to another person the day before.
Right. And also the idea of haves and have-nots in a small town is, you know, the have-nots.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the other side of the tracks isn't a joke in a small town. It's a real demographic, but it's people you went to school with. It's people you have to come in contact with all the time. It's not like in New York, you know, it's very different than that. So you have to, it preys on the fact that not Georgie or Bill, they're from probably the right side of the tracks, but Beverly is definitely from the wrong side of the tracks. And they all have to, and Stan's mother, again, hates him being friends with these losers. She thinks they're losers. And he likes to play on that, I think, a lot. Mm. Stand By Me is another haves and have-nots.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, let's talk about some of the dramatic pieces. during a Q&A, he talked about how he does summers in, was it Pensacola? He does summers in Florida.
Gross.
He makes a joke about, you know, you hit a certain age and everybody, it's the law.
It's
you
very go, cold in Maine.
So he does his summers down there. An older woman recognizes him. And she says, "You, I know you. You're on the television. Are you Stephen King?" And he goes, "Yes." And she goes, "I don't like your movies. I don't like your stories. Too scary, too violent. I like stuff like Shawshank Redemption."
Yeah.
And he tells her, he's like, "I wrote Shawshank Redemption." She's like, "No, you didn't."
No, you didn't.
But I think it speaks to his humanity that he contrasts these tales of terror with like some of the most dramatic, heartfelt, you know, sometimes tragedies, sure, but mm-hmm. like sometimes wholly redeeming stories. And I think it also, I wonder if it says anything that they're oftentimes short stories. So like Shawshank Redemption, Stand By Me,
mm-hmm.
The other dramas are coming to mind. I guess
Apt Pupil is a drama. I mean, it's horrific things, but it's a drama, not supernatural. So to me, I put that out of horror.
Sure.
In that way. And yeah. Mr. Mercedes is a drama. That's a recent book of his. Okay. It's horror because it's horrific. It's about a man who, a kid, who gets into a car one day, just decides he's going to mow over this group of people in a car, and he kills like hundreds of people in this parking lot, basically. And it's about him and mental illness, which is interesting. There's nothing supernatural about it. He's just a bad guy, you know, so that's, and Joyland's kind of a mix. That's one of his,
that's
like
the carnival.
Yeah, the carnival.
Carny folk.
And there is like an idea of ghosts in there, but again, it's about this guy's summer from college and how he met these people and he became autonomous in that way. It's about a coming of age story, really, which is essentially the body. Stand By Me is coming of age. They're just much younger.
There was something that he had said that it stuck out. When he was referring to 11/22/63, a novel, he called it work. He said he still runs across books on the time, the 60s, Kennedy, and he cringes because it's just reminiscent of work. It sort of speaks to, I thought, how he defers to a writer character because it's familiar. If the guy's job isn't important, then fuck it, make him a writer.
Yeah.
Because it's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So if the idea is just to get the story rolling and it's about a guy, it's not about a plumber. It's not a, you know, if his job doesn't matter.
It's what he knows. You write what you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you'll find, and not now so much, but a lot of times you'll find early on that the writer was also an alcoholic.
Mm.
Because he wrote what he knew. And if I think one of the best things to tell you in the mind space that Stephen King was in is to read The Dark Half, which is about the writer and then his character, who is his pseudonym writer name.
Right. They made the movie with Timothy Hutton.
Oh, yeah. I watched that recently.
Does it hold up? I haven't seen that one.
No, because George Stark, that's the bad guy writer, is... No, he's like got like greasy hair slicked back, and it's really absurd. It's just absurd.
He's kind of
but I love the book
character, isn't he? And in the movie, I remember images of like, I don't know, he looks like a junky zombie by the end of it.
Yeah, because he starts to fall apart as the story goes on. Because when if the writer doesn't write under him and use him, he starts to fall apart. Okay. So that's why slowly he starts to like decompose.
That's interesting.
You know,
the idea of the writer who's the alcoholic, I started thinking when you're as prolific as he is, and I think he's written in the neighborhood of 55 books. That was a couple of years ago, so the number's probably up since then.
Yeah, 54 novels, 11 collections, and 7 novellas.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. When he's written as many books as he has, I swear, not being familiar and hearing about the car accident that he was in, I assumed that after the car accident, he wrote Misery. But it turns out he wrote it like 20 years before. And it's just the tragedy of when you're as prolific as he is that like there are going to be life events that mirror shit you thought of.
Oh, definitely.
I don't believe in the idea of like manifesting stuff like that unless it's really over the top. But I can't begin to imagine what it was like for him to be debilitated. And well, I guess he talked about taking a long break from writing.
Mm-hmm.
And recently he did an interview on Terry Gross's Fresh Air where she asked him about that and the sort of that state and how he talked about taking a break from writing and he was in a really bad headspace. He was like, yeah, that was the OxyContin talking. I was in a really dark place and it wasn't helped by the drugs I was on and the really painful physical therapy. So it was only in that state where, you know, he was slowed down as a writer. But eventually, like, you know, the moment you need an outlet, you know, he's back to being himself again.
So it's interesting about the misery and then the car getting hit and everything. Because in Rage, the book Rage, that was before it was Columbine, before a lot of the school shootings. But he had written Rage about a school shooting, about a psycho kid who shoots up the school. And then now it's out of print because it just happens all the time now, school shootings. So he doesn't allow that to be in print anymore.
Oh, it's his call. Wow.
Yeah. He just let it fall out of print. And it was in a Bachman series, like a 3 Bachman books kind of a
thing. Okay. Could you talk about that? Because that's his alias.
Bachman's is like alter ego.
What's the full name?
Richard Bachman.
Richard Bachman.
But you call him the Bachman books, which is, again, then it's almost like you have to read The Dark Half because that's George Stark is Bachman, I think, essentially. Okay. And then Stephen King. And when he became popular, he wanted to say, yeah, I can still do this. I can still write a good story and not use my name. Mm-hmm. So he did some Bachman books and they were successful, but people figured out who it was. And I think kind of early on, people knew he was Richard Bachman.
So I guess now that the cat's out of the bag, he doesn't use the pen name anymore.
I think the last one he did was, he did the twin books. He did Regulators and Desperation. And so, Bachman wrote the Regulators and Stephen King wrote Desperation.
Okay.
They're essentially the same characters. They look the same and it's essentially the same bad guy, which is this, bunch of spirits from miners. But they mirror each other, the books. And so you have to kind of read them together. Yeah. They're pretty good. Desperation, they did a movie, a bad TV movie.
Oh, in the desert.
Yeah.
The movie had...
It's Ron Perlman, I think.
Ron Perlman as the sheriff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was
The book
about
is
that.
So good, though. I have to keep telling you, like, the book is good because you watch the film and you think it's shitty.
Yeah, no, I think it's a recurring thing. Again, so I've read very little of this stuff, but I have a pretty big appreciation for what I have read. And yeah, the movie adaptations are going to miss the mark, it seems like, maybe 8 out of 10 times.
Yeah, yeah. Because even the one that you like, which is The Shining,
is pretty far from the original.
It's nothing like the book.
Source material.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is kind of almost a throwaway. I rewatched portions of Maximum Overdrive. One of the things that stands out is in the opening credits, and they're like, and music by AC/DC. He's a big AC/DC fan, but Maximum Overdrive was a studio giving him the reins and just saying, like, make something original from scratch that we can put your name all over it. And like a kid in a candy store, he starts, you know, sort of deferring to like the visual, you know, inanimate objects murdering people. I thought on the timeline, interestingly, it falls between The Omen and like Final Destination movies, but the idea of like the coincidence of, well, I no, it's not coincidence because these things are animated.
Yes.
But it, I don't know, it seems really childish, like way too indulgent to really hold up.
Well, I think, yeah, Maximum Overdrive is like, I don't know, when did Clive Barker start writing? To me, it reminds me of Clive Barker. It would be something that Clive Barker would be into, fantastic shenanigans like that. Sorry, I can't help you with Maximum Overdrive. Terrible.
It's okay. It really just, it deserves a note because it's the only movie he's ever directed. I think there was definitely an element of like, this shit is harder than it looks. Like when it comes to writing, that is your sport and you play it well. And then he gets to directing actors and telling prop guys that like, okay, I I want this toaster to attack the lady or what have you. And they're just like, really?
And he's like, yes.
Is a yes. And I want it to be believable.
Oh, we got that. Right on that, Don.
This isn't even the first killer toaster we've made. I think maybe one of the biggest troubles that the stories come into in terms of not translating well. And it's funny that we think of movies as engrossing and as this sort of experience that you can sort of lose yourself and enjoy, but it really doesn't compare to what's happening with the book. And I was just thinking in terms of the senses, like with movies, you see and you hear, but in the books, you're getting the entire sensory input. You're getting, if he decides that this room smells like a rotting corpse, then that's what you have in your mind. But
you can't have an actor say, boy, this room smells like a rotting corpse. Yeah. And then the audience says, oh, thank you.
It always strikes me, and I guess in like zombie stories specifically, there's always the idea of like death around you. But whenever actors pretend that something smells terrible, I giggle. Like I don't buy it for a second. It seems so silly. And it's never, ever been communicated well on screen.
Because it always comes off like a stinky fart. If you think something smells, that's what I assume.
But it's like a silent movie of a stinky fart. Yeah, no, it's a lot of people like holding their nose and squinting their face. Or like
putting something over their face. Yeah,
yeah. No. It all seems pretty goofy. But he does have access to like even the tactile thing, which goes really far. When you think of terms of like a visceral reaction to fear, the hair standing up on your arm, like there are sensory elements that might not call attention to themselves necessarily, but it goes a long way in sort of relaying terror. I don't know. Every once in a while, a movie sort of touches, gets it right. Like movies like The Thing that take place in the Arctic, like sometimes cold feels like it translates.
But, right. You can get that. Or closeness, like The Descent.
Yeah.
You get the idea of
closeness. Yeah, the claustrophobia. The claustrophobia of a setting. Yeah, definitely. But it doesn't come up very often, the idea that like he's playing with all the senses and doing it well, whereas a film is going to be limited in a dozen different ways.
I think, that's a lot of the problem, especially with It. You never get the idea of how big it is in the deadlights. You can't ever understand. In the book, it's something you cannot look at it. Don't look at it. You know, you can't, or you're going to get fucked. So they did like big flashlights in the movie base, essentially. And you go, that's not deadlights. That's not scary. That, you know, but you can't have something that's completely intangible.
Right.
On film.
Yeah. And I think as special effects are getting better and better, they bridge certain gaps. But it's funny to think that it's sort of the beauty and simplicity of writing that one word costs as much as the next. Like he is writing these epic pieces, which, you know, if you were to try and do it verbatim, it would cost $1 billion. But it's sort of the beauty of and simplicity of writing that you are asking the imagination to build this setting. And there's no limit to that. That I kind of enjoy. And it's one of the reasons I really do want to read more of the books.
That's why, to me, I go back to the Stand movie because I think you have to read the book and then you watch the movie of the Stand and you say, oh, that's how all my friends looked. You know, it's like reading about your friends. Oh, this is the hardship my friend suffered. And oh, that's my friend was Gary Sinise and Molly Ringwald and that kid time. From Parker Lewis. Oh, wow. He's a bad guy. You know, so it's kind of, you have to put in the missing information in the film and you have to be able to suspend the belief of the terrible fashion of the time to get back to the true part of the story and say, oh, this is how my friends looked and acted this out.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny. Even watching the miniseries, like there was money involved. It was a huge production and a lot of it was on, it's funny, the 4:3 ratio because it did get made for television at the time. You could see production value, but you could not feel scope. And that, I guess they're talking about redoing The Stand and, you know, one or two movies. It'll be interesting when you sort of open up the world a little bit more and you sort of get the idea of like the depletion of the human race and plague on a massive scale.
If you hadn't like an Australian filmmaker, because Australians love to show vast, big parts of scenery, that would be amazing because it is a vast book. It's a whole new world that he created. And that is like Lord of the Rings in that way because it's the United States that we know, but it's not. There's a lot of walking. That's Randall Flagg is the walking dude. That's what they call him in the book. So,
wow, that is very 70s. The walking dude.
The walking dude. You quit crapping on that book.
His relationship with Frank Darabont, I find fascinating. And I really get a kick out of the idea that Darabont's talked about the first time he contacted King. He made The Woman in the Room. And at the time, Frank Darabont wasn't Frank Darabont as we know him. He was still like up and coming. And Stephen King was really cool about giving giving access to his material, like licensing that and, you know, like the product that came from it. And, you know, after that was Shawshank Redemption. After that was Green Mile. After that was The Mist. Those are all movies that hold up. Really good examples of like someone who loves the content. And even if there's going to be like a ratings difficulty and, you know, making something too violent or what have you, like we'll work around it to sort of give respect to the source material.
I think it's a difference between understanding the medium in a way that Stephen King doesn't understand visual medium or doesn't understand the filmmaking medium. He understands books and that's what he does. And Darabont's in a different, he's not just a story writer. Storyteller.
Right. Well, that he comes from a background of writing, even they have that in common. Frank Darabont, for everything he's directed, he's written two other scripts that have, you know, either been used or he wrote a script for the last Indiana Jones movie that a lot of people liked. It didn't get used.
Obviously.
Yeah, that was a piece of garbage.
No, but Stephen King, I think, for lots of people, he's actually very open with working with other people in the collaborations that he's done. And in the old Clive Barker films, he's one of the guys who originally said, this is the next guy. This guy is amazing. You know, and he was a huge supporter of early Clive Barker in that in that way. And he writes in the forewords, he's, you know, always, this is the next guy. Look at this guy. He's a very supportive writer.
Cool.
And obviously he's supportive of his, you know, kids that write, his son that writes, and he wrote with Joe Hill.
And even his wife
writes,
a couple of books.
It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
Creatures who feast upon the flesh of their victims.
I ate his liver with some fava beans.
Soylent Green is made out of people.
Feeding time.
During today's Lunch Hour Reviews, we're going to be going over The Babadook. It was written and directed by Jennifer Kent. She's an Australian filmmaker. Off the bat, I'm going to say I would recommend it. It was one of my favorite movies in a good while. Melinda, what were your first?
I maybe was oversold the film, actually, by you. I thought it was good. I thought there were parts that were really scary. I could take it or leave it.
Yeah.
I think my final, and I thought about it a long time because it made me think a lot, which makes me think, oh, maybe it's better than I'm giving it credit for. But I could take it or leave it. I thought about watching it again, and I said, no, I'm not really interested.
I'm kind of eager to go back. Okay, so going into some of the specifics without any spoilers, I like the kid, and I've been thinking that, like, as much of he's kind of a prick, he's so much of the story kind of suffers from, like, these are issues that should have been resolved a long time ago. Like, this is all the product of festering, not ignorance, but ignoring a problem. And the kid was kind of, he was this unchecked, he was practically feral.
That's because she had checked out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so he's left to run around and be a little asshole.
To parent himself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you're a little kid, I mean, you'd probably think that was awesome. You know, you have your own.
Yeah. It's funny, it made me so uncomfortable. I was reminded, I'd wanted to track down, what was the movie with Tilda Swinton? The Issue with Kevin? Something with Kevin.
The Problem.
The Problem with Kevin? And it sounded like the same sort of thing where a parent is at their wit's end and they don't like they don't have a solution.
But I don't know if this mother was really at her wit's end. She just didn't bond with the child, which is...
Oh, I think eventually she was at her wit's end.
Yes. Wow. I thought, yeah. But I think she just didn't bond with him, which is a real thing that happens. And you're told as a mother, if that does happen, you're a terrible person. And so I thought, I took it, I guess, maybe from like a lady point of view in that way and saying like, I kind of felt really bad for her because you understand why she can't bond with him because he's a little weirdo. He's a weirdo.
Yeah. And he's, yeah. Yeah. I sympathize with her above all, at least for the, you know, first half of the movie. He was so bad. I was recurring jokes about just horrible kids, whether it's Louis C.K. calling his kid an asshole, or there was a joke I remember hearing about during a podcast that this comedian Brian Holtzman used to have a bit about the Susan Smith woman who drowned her kids in the car. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, I heard those were bad kids. I heard they sat right in front of the TV. They didn't put their blocks away. They constantly spilled their milk. Those kids will not be missed.
It's horrible, but kind of you're like, maybe this kid could get killed off and I'd be just fine with it. At the beginning of the movie, you say, I could take or leave this character.
Yeah, it's funny that his might be the most interesting arc in the movie. But yeah, so on that note, the idea of a stress-causing child, it seems like a lot of movies have a hard time relaying stress and characters who are sort of, you know, they're thinning out and thinning out and they're eventually worn away. But I really liked this process, that it really was symbolic of someone who hasn't slept forever.
She was great. I thought the actress was, I thought everyone in the film actually was really great at the acting.
Yeah.
But it was the story that I could take or leave. Yeah. But I thought the acting, she was amazing.
Yeah. I guess I don't know. I guess there were a few X-Files episodes that sort of touched on the idea of like exhaustion. And I don't know, like in college, I had those moments where like I was seeing shit after enough days without sleep or maybe 2 hours here, 1 hour there. Like you start getting snuck up on by shit that isn't there. And I thought this movie did that really well.
Yeah.
And where it was like familiar territory. Do you ever stay up during finals?
No, I was a music major. No. I stayed up drinking. Yes.
At which point things might feel like they're sleep. It's sneaking up just because your response time is delayed.
Exactly. Because I was drunk or something.
That's a funny segue. But music, there isn't really musical score. There are a couple pieces of music that are integrated into scenes. I really like the combination of like sound effects and ominous tones.
The sound effects were awesome. It was an old-fashioned style, I thought. Old-fashioned meaning like 70s of telling sounds or scored sounds, even though it's not a score for the whole film, but it's scored sounds for the scene.
Yeah, and I it was effectively trippy when a piece of score might be turned off when she switches the radio or that kind of thing happens once or twice, that they integrate the sound in the scene to what she's actually experiencing.
Right. I think it's doubling sometimes as her thought pattern, her thought process, and even the kid in one of the scenes.
Yeah. So my affinity for it comes from the pretty effective play of, is this real? Is it not? Is it in her head? Is it external? This book is haunting, and the kid has specific experience with it, so you could never say it's entirely in her head. Without going into spoilers, it becomes less and less a question. I thought the psychological play I really enjoyed.
I thought the introduction of the book, and when she starts reading the book, that was one of the most tense scenes that I think I might have seen in a while. I mean, so I'm not saying like the movie overall is don't watch it, but she starts reading the Babadook story and it rhymes and it's a children's story, but the artwork in the book is awesome. It's very scary. And that
it's a pop-up book is not something, I don't think it would occur to like 9 out of 10 filmmakers who, like adding a third dimension and like, you know, knives going across throats.
Right. This was an interactive pop-up book.
Yeah. It was gorgeous artwork. And that they translated a number of the things from the book to images that we might see on screen. Yeah, there were some
great
moments.
That was amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And so I found myself in a lot of the scenes after she first reads the book. In a lot of the scenes, I find myself looking in the corners of the scenes to see, like, what I can catch.
Like the police station on the coat hook.
Yeah, and anytime then you see anything on a coat hook, I was like, what is that?
In summation, I thought the broader theme was sort of about addressing tragedy, addressing trauma. And we talked earlier the idea of, like, this is a story of a festering problem that was avoided. And even her insomnia, like, they talk about people with insomnia as having a subconscious sense of not getting enough done. And so that's kind of them, you know, the irony is whoever stays up with insomnia isn't exactly getting shit done.
Exactly.
But it is your brain kind of telling you, like, there's more work to be done.
Sure.
In her case, like, there was a whole, I mean, she had trauma to deal with that she just didn't.
Yeah. Lots of stuff. To me, it was about shutting down. Shutting down and just, like, cutting off from everything. Cutting off from her sister. Cutting off from the kid. She's been doing this for now. How old's the kid? 9 years or something.
Yeah.
So to me, it's just, like, a woman who is just completely shut down. And this is what happens if you just turn off your relationships with other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it speaks to the story that it only gets worse as she isolates herself more.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of speaks to, like, you know, people who might have suffered with mental illness and sort of, you know, I'm not going to go into too many details, but like, depression is isolating because you feel like you have this filthy disease that God forbid you share it with people and it's just going to ruin other people.
Right. But her sister's an asshole too, though. Her sister's really rude.
Yeah.
Like, really horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not saying she's, you know, there isn't reason for a lot of the one, but, like, the coworker, and yeah, I don't know.
The coworker, did you recognize him?
No.
Snowtown Murders.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Oh, you should watch that one. It's really good. It's on Netflix.
I guess it's Australian?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He walked on screen and I go, oh, I know that guy. Snowtown Murders.
Okay, so that's our review for Babadook. I'm a yay. Mindy is
I'm
a nay.
Babadook.
In his essay, Why We Crave Horror Movies, Stephen King wrote, "The mythic horror movie, like a sick joke, has a dirty job to do. It deliberately appeals to all that is worst in us. It is morbidity unchained, our most base instincts set free, our nastiest fantasies realized, and it all happens, fittingly enough, in the dark. For those reasons, good liberals often shy away from horror films. For myself, I like to see the most aggressive of them, Dawn of the Dead, for instance, as lifting a trap door in the civilized forebrain and throwing a basket of raw meat to the hungry alligator swimming around in that subterranean river beneath. Why bother?
Why bother?
Because it keeps them from getting out, man. It keeps them down there and me up here. It was Lennon and McCartney who said, all you need is love. And I would agree with that, as long as you keep the gators fed.